episode 34 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panellists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey, Brian.
Runner-up for the 2015 Melbourne Regionals and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
It really is a nice day today.
Yes, he's also the human first number one target as well. Wilfie, do you have anything to say about that?
I was hoping we wouldn't air that on the show, but
if
you can get... if you see one of my clones, then... let's stay away from them or whatever. I don't really know.
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
Yeah, I'll tell Wilfie 1.0 that you said hi.
Webmaster of StimHack and the 2014 World Champion, Dan D'Argenio. And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. Thanks so much once again, Dan, for coming on the show. We had some great feedback about your presence last week. So we wanted to get straight into it this week by talking about regionals. We're in the middle of regional season. As competitive players, one of the things we like to talk about are what are the decks that are going to come to light after all these regionals have finished up? What's all the top eight going to look like? Is there going to be a real widespread of decks? We've talked about how it's been a really experimental season. So maybe start with Dan, because you're on the show. What do you think are the best decks, and what are your like picks for that are going to be the most common to see in the top eight or even the top four?
On the Corp side, you've got Replicating Perfection, fresh off of a NEH nerf in the form of Clot. I think Replicating Perfection was the other tier one deck to NEH ever since NEH came out, really. And now this is pretty much the most significant blow NEH has taken. So now basically just, I guess by default, now RP looks like it's the deck to beat on the Corp side. There's other decks that are good too. You can still play NEH. There's a couple of good Blue Sun variants. There's actually a couple of good NEH variants. You can try and kill people out of that faction too. And there's all sorts of flavors of HB that people are playing now. People are starting to sort of merge the ideas of HB Glacier and HB Fast Advance. So you're seeing all kinds of weird stuff. HB with Biotic Labor and Caprice Nisei in it. Basically anything you can imagine. It turns out that one extra credit for installing things every turn is really good, and it doesn't matter what good cards you put in that deck.
Yeah, I actually, funnily enough, arrived at a similar conclusion. I'd been playing that HB mid-range deck we talked about a while ago, and I was like, man, I just want Biotic Labor. So I jammed Biotics in, and I ran that at regionals. And the one mistake I made was...
not playing three of them?
Well, no, I did play three Biotics, but I didn't play enough 3-for-2s. I needed to cut one of my 5-for-3s and play 3 Vitruvius instead of 1, and I would have been much better. So yeah, I think that the HB sort of rush deck that's playing big ice like Tollbooth, playing Caprice, but also playing Biotic and the 3-for-2s is pretty well placed at the moment.
Yeah, I'm super excited about a list I've been kind of experimenting with Kaylee Haplin and
Haley Kaplan.
Kaylee Haplin and Stealth.
Haley Kaplan.
And a Stealth Rig. So what I've been doing is kind of bridging a gap between the early cloaks and early lockpicks using a refractor. And when I'm not running, I use those cloaks and lockpicks to power up a study guide and then transition out of the refractor into a switchblade. So it's a really great rig with Lady.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah, it's super.
You like that idea, Dan?
It's wild, I'll say that.
Yeah, and then like all these pieces come together with Haley's kind of auto scripture ability. You just get, yeah, kind of just professional contacts 3 times a turn and spam some stuff out. Or like I'm playing 3 modded and 3 career fair as well. And oh my God, career fair is insane. It's exactly what the doctor ordered for like these kind of dedicated, I want 3 Earthrise Hotel kind of spam decks. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. And I think it's really good. I'm going to keep testing with it as much as I can.
Dan, due to the fact that Australia exists outside of the general scope of space and time, it did take us quite a long time to get the most recent data packs in. So we haven't really seen anything from the Valley or Breaker Bay really come to light. Has Haley been making a bit of impact in the US meta at the moment?
I mean, people are trying her out. I don't think anybody's really broken through the gates with Haley. It's just, man, it is really difficult to overcome Kate's ability.
Yeah.
The problem I think that Haley has is, it's much more difficult to get good value out of her ability than it is to get good value out of Kate's, like, to match just the pure economic value that Kate will get you. And then on top of it, I think that her issue right now is that there isn't enough benefit of being able to put stuff into play instant speed sort of deal from your hand. It's like more of like edge cases. I've seen it be useful a couple of times, but you can't really count on it. She doesn't have like, Haley doesn't really have this card that you really, really want to be playing because it's so good with Haley specifically. And I think that's what she's missing right now.
I think I agree with you. I've actually seen some people testing with it and they've actually made suboptimal plays just to be able to trigger her ability. Like, for instance, I saw someone, at the end of my turn, wanted to SMC something in order to play something else from their hand at the same time. In doing so, they overwrit one of their corroders or something like that. And similarly, I've seen people hold on to, like, a clone ship because they want to wait and draw their lockpick so they can play them both in the same click rather than just playing the game as you normally would in the meantime and looking at Haley's ability as an upside, which is occasionally relevant. So it'd be interesting to see if people can overcome that sort of odd hump.
Yeah, it's definitely wacky trying to put it together.
Yeah, I think some of the things you said, I feel similarly about that. Self-modifying code and clone ship are two of the best shaper cards, and they go in basically all the shaper decks, regardless of how slow or how fast you are. And they work so well with Haley because they let you maximize the ability using it multiple times per turn, but they also work really well with Kate, like the original shaper identity, just because clone ship doesn't cost you anything. Like, the same kind of, you get similar sorts of efficiency using Kate on the good shaper cards that you do with Haley, but Kate is a bit more flexible. So I think that the main advantage is of Haley will be, as Shilzy correctly pointed out, that lets you turn your contacts, lets you deploy your contacts cards more quickly. And those contacts decks always used contacts more times than they wanted to in a turn. Like, you usually ended up discarding with most of your turns, even if the game was going well. And Haley lets you leverage that in a way that Kate doesn't as much, I think.
Yeah, this is why I've been particularly excited to put it in a stealth deck. It's just something that you guys kind of commented on with Hollis's Stealth Andy list. The way it worked was that it turned cards into economy, and the way you did that was by spending clicks to turn those cards into efficiency. And Haley gets that at a lower cost, and at the same time you have contacts in faction, which is why that particular build excites me quite a lot. If there are a lot of kind of, I guess, fallacies for people to kind of get over, that change in mindset will be necessary before she reaches like real tier one capacity.
So aside from, I guess, like the Andy builds that we've seen before, which are good, and prepaid Kate, which I think at least in the United States has emerged as the clear front runner for runners. If she's not I think she's definitely a step above everybody else right now, Kate is. But aside from that, one deck that's been popping up here and been gaining in popularity is the Reyna Headlock deck. And I think this is like a really, really cool deck. I think it's taken like Denial to this really new level. It used to be that Denial was like all about just like playing as many account siphons as you can. But this is an account siphonless Denial deck, and it functions on a really great capacity, has a reasonable RP matchup, and has been putting up some good results.
Like, what's the basis of the deck, Dan? Why is it, what has changed in the meta that's allowed Reyna, which is a runner who's been around for quite a while, to suddenly become a forerunner?
Okay, so there's a few things. Obviously, like, Order and Chaos just brings this new level of power to Anarchs that they didn't have before, which just increases, it just raises all the boats in the faction. So there's a little bit of that. But the big interaction that came with Order and Chaos is Eater plus Crescentis. And, you know, when we saw Eater, we were thinking Account Siphon. You saw Wands and Destruction. You knew about Keyhole. There were all these things that everybody wanted to try. Crescentis is not one of those things. Like, nobody was like, man, I can't wait to build my Eater Crescentis deck. But Sam Swede over here built an Eater deck with no Account Siphons, got a couple of Vamps. I think he's down to one Keyhole now. And then the main function of Eater is to combo with Crescentis. The plan being, your Reyna, their ice costs more to res. You can play a Xanadu, make it cost even more to res. And then, you know, you run at a Lotus Field, they res it for 7, and you use your Lotus, you use your Eater Crescentis, you break the Lotus Field for 3, and you de-res it. And the next time you run there, they're going to think twice about having, you know, how many times can you pay 7 for a Lotus Field in the game? Not that many. So in combination with Clone Ship to recur the Crescentis, Vamp to sort of attack a corp who refuses to spend any money, and a few other nice touches, you know, like I've Had Worse, Earthrise Hotel. We've been switching back and forth between Vigil and Desperado, not really sure what the best console is, but both are great. You know, it's just a really awesome functional Denial deck. It uses Knight to get into remote servers and get into servers early when you need an access, and it uses Eater as sort of the main power breaker that lets you use Crescentis and Keyhole and Vamp and stuff like that at your whim.
I've played against this deck a few times now, and one of the problems I think I've identified with it is that Reyna is so one-dimensional as an identity. You basically know that they're going to be playing some variation of this strategy, that if they just spend all their resources trying to gain credits and gain and accumulate credits, and, you know, don't score until very, very late in the game, and don't try and create a remote too early and stuff like that, then the deck, I found, it just basically crumbles if your opponent, and since Reyna only does one thing, they can kind of plan for this from turn one. And have you found a way to deal with that problem?
Well, it's certainly the problem with the deck. No doubt about it. I think that it's part of its success right now is due to people not understanding the degree to which you have to just do nothing but make money against Reyna. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, I got a scoring window for my Nisei Mark II. I'll get that counter. And they're like, sure, spend all that money. You know, they'll run and face check the ice, and then you res it, and then they just come at your HQ and ruin you. But yeah, so there's some degree of it just being successful because, I mean, that's a problem for the deck. Knight is really helpful. It lets you pretty much question, no questions asked, get into remote to trash, you know, an economy asset. So if you can keep the Corp off their economy assets, it's pretty good. Also, Scrubber is the one that's in and out of the deck. Scrubber also helps you, you know, get rid of those assets without hurting too much on your side. And then eventually, if you can win that money race, you just vamp them and win.
Yeah, I think one way I'm looking forward to taking the deck is to try out a few of the Silverware Suite, as well as David, and just really plan for this long game scenario as well. So that way I can choose what ice that I can leave resed and just cut it down when I have the chance. Because they work quite well with either as well, in my opinion.
No, I agree.
Dan, we know that you have a little bit of a love affair with RP. I mean, you did win Worlds with it last year. So where do you think the list is at the moment? You did mention that now Klotz around Nirith Hub is much to the disappointment of everybody on the internet about a year ago, I want to say. Where do you think the deck's headed and where is it at the moment?
Well, it's undergone a pretty interesting sort of a series of changes since Worlds. The deck we're looking at now that a lot of people are doing well in regionals with is a lot different than the deck that was being played even 3 months ago, which is a lot different than the deck played at Worlds. At Worlds, you know, I was playing Enhanced Login Protocol to help deal with a little bit of noise resurgence as well as just the criminal run economy in general. That was pretty good then. But, you know, since then, Order and Chaos has come out. There's been a lot of changes. The first major change that hit RP was Switchblade. When people realized that they could play Stealth Criminal with Switchblade, Kamino, Strugi, and Pop started to look like a big joke, and you could run all over that RP list. As a way of sort of dealing with that, they RP lists shifted away from all these ridiculous sentries, started moving towards Grail, which also, you know, just came out. People wanted to use that. And the Grail decks were pretty good. They took advantage of the lack of Parasites, which is a weakness of Grail. People stopped playing Parasites in as many things. They took the Data Suckers out of Kate, mostly because it's not very good against Nirith Hub. So the people were playing RP Grail for a while, and now, with RP being basically the deck to beat, everybody's playing Parasites and all sorts of ways to deal with RP. People are going in a number of different directions, but the main one I've seen is a change in the ice package. Instead of a focus on sentries, which basically no deck had an easy way of breaking before, now RP is starting to focus more on code gates. People are still mostly running Eli. People are still playing Pop. You've got a new sentry in Cortex Lock, which sort of fights Mimic a little bit better and is cheaper to res in the early game, so it's less bad if it gets destroyed. But the main focus are on some code gates that we've been getting. First of all, with Yogg sort of out of the picture in some ways, Enigma is pretty much auto-include in RP right now. I didn't even play it in my Worlds deck, but everybody's playing Enigma. Viper is a reasonable try. More Toll Booths is always great. Toll Booth is one of the only reliably taxing pieces of ice in the game right now. The only really good way to deal with it is like Femme. So Toll Booths are great. Lotus Fields are great against the Surge of Anarchs, even if they're not that great against Kate's Cyber Ciphers. And then the big new one that we've got is Crick, which is the positional ice that if you put, it's a one cost code gate, 3 strength, gets 3 additional strength on Archive, so it becomes a 1-cost 6 strength, which is just completely ridiculous. And the subroutine is it lets you install a card from the heap into play. RP has an easy time taking advantage of that. If, you know, you get your mental health clinics or Jackson or Caprice or whatever, there's so many things you want to bring back.
There were even top decks at Worlds that were playing interns in their RP decks. Were you playing interns? Or
yeah, I had one interns. That was
yeah, actually... So it's obviously an effect that you want in RP. So being able to get it off such a powerful piece of ice is great.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, it's gotten to the point here where Crick's been out long enough that If you put an ice on archives and you're playing RP, nobody ever runs it ever. Like, they'll just let you have archives forever because there's such a good chance that it's a crick, and every time that's a blowout.
Yeah. What are some of the other changes that you've seen with RP? So the ice has changed around. What are the agendas still looking like? Nisei, Future Perfect, and NAPD.
Okay, so the agendas have been undergoing some changes. There's actually a number of options, and we've been doing a lot of math on StimHack, running the numbers about, you know, which agenda packages are the safest from runner accesses, how many accesses can you get, what is the chance that the runner can win after 12 accesses, for example, based on your agenda suite. So there's a few different things. You can play the one that I played at Worlds with 3 Future Perfect, 3 Nisei, 3 NAPD, but I think that we've come to the conclusion that one is probably suboptimal. It plays 21 points, which is a bad idea. And I thought that when I built that deck and I was playing it, it felt like it was fishy. I was happy with it because the deck was winning, and I felt like, oh, well, one of my agendas is the future. That extra agenda is the Future Perfect. That's not really worth 3 points. But what you can do is you can cut an NAPD and you can play a 1-pointer, like Chronos Project, which has come out since Worlds, and is a great, like, sort of hate card. You never really want to score the 1-pointer for points. So Chronos is great because it's such a powerful effect that can just change the game on its own that when you do want to score it, it's actually worth it, as opposed to all the other 3-1 agendas, which you just would never want to score.
Yeah, I also feel like in RP, having an agenda you can score straight off the board without signaling is actually a really good thing to have, because it's something just people don't expect most of the time.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, people tried one Philotic Entanglement over the 3rd Future Perfect, and I don't think that there's a ton of value in having an agenda that you can sneak by, mostly because the deck is so good at being able to score an agenda without anything you can really do about it anyway. But it is nice. You usually don't want to take the tempo hit to do it. Usually you want to be scoring Niseis, which sort of like pays itself back in tempo 2 times over because of the counter just being that powerful.
Yeah, and I guess what we saw in a lot of your games from Worlds, and a lot of people would know this who've played RP a lot, is that you cannot get to a situation where you haven't scored any points and they might have scored 6, but because you can chain those Niseis, scoring is not really the problem.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Getting to that point.
Exactly. You want to get to the point where you're safe scoring. Sneaking by agendas actually, while it's really easy in RP, it actually sort of works against your game plan because you're doing something besides advancing your board state.
Yeah, I just had a question about the movement towards code gates. Why not barriers?
Okay, so the issue with sentries is Switchblade exists. The issue with barriers is that Lady exists. So the problem is, like, there aren't enough barriers that cost Lady 2 counters in that you can play in RP. One of them is Galahad, but you need to commit your whole ice suite to Growl to play that reasonably. One of them is Ashigaru, which has a ton of subroutines and can basically attack the Lady by itself. And for that reason, it's actually one of the main barriers people are choosing to play just to fight Ashigaru. But it runs into other issues. You can break it with Atman on 4, which a lot of shapers will get out anyway. And then you can also just, like if somebody parasites your Ashigaru, you, like, lose on the spot because it's, like, such a bad tempo play. But, yeah, Lady's why you're not playing a ton of barriers. Lady's just so efficient.
So, Dan, on the flip side there, are you not worried enough about Refractor?
The thing about Refractor is, like, Refractor, while it's a super efficient breaker, it's still not that great against code gates when you compare it to Lady and Switchblade, because you still have to pay money to break subroutines. I mean, obviously, you need to play a stealth credit for Switchblade, but it breaks any number. The thing about Refractor is you're still paying 2 to break Enigma, which you would have been basically with anything. You're still paying 2 to break, like, Yagura. You have to pump it twice to get to Crick. Tollbooth still taxes for 3. And Lotus Field isn't that great against you for the money, but it's still reasonable. So, yeah, Refractor is a good breaker. I'm actually more worried about Cyber Cipher than I am Refractor, because it gets up there and breaks the Lotus Field for 1, which is, you know, really cheap. And that's one of the reasons why I'm playing so many code gates right now, is with Shaper being on the Cyber Cipher scavenge plan, one of the ways you can actually beat that is by playing so many code gates that they have to scavenge it all the time.
One of the interesting things you mentioned is that Yogg has sort of been on the way out, and this Enigma plan, Yagura plan, I've sort of lent into including those cards in a lot of my Jinteki builds as well. But do you think there's space for Yogg to come back into the meta? I've seen a few Anarchalists playing it, but I haven't seen it really splashed into Criminals or Shapers recently.
Okay, well, I mean, I splashed Yogg at Worlds in Andy, and Lotus was out, and it was great for me. I think that Criminal still should be splashing Yogg because of how great of a synergy it has with Desperado and security testing. Like, even if, you know, yeah, you know, like basically, like, every code gate you turn off, like, suddenly that's, like, a way to get money again. So I like it in Criminal still. And I've been playing it in Max and Anarch as a one-of, alongside Zoo for decks that are playing Lotus Field. But against decks that aren't playing Lotus Field, I'd much rather install a Yogg. And then on top of that, Net Ready Eyes is about to come out. I don't know when you guys are going to see it, but it's a spoiled card. It's a Shaper Hardware. It should be out in the United States, I think, within 2 weeks. For those of you who don't know what it does, it's a Cybernetics. It's zero-cost Shaper Hardware for 2 influence. When you install it, you take 2 meat damage. And at the it says, at the beginning of every run you initiate, you choose an icebreaker. That icebreaker has +1 strength for the remainder of the run.
I'm just worried that that's going to make a big difference, because the thing is, we already had the Personal Touch, which was, I know it's a card that a lot of people haven't been excited by, but it's another 2 influence card that we could have splashed out of Shaper Faction anytime we like onto that Yogg.
But I mean, Net Ready Eyes is a bit more flexible than that, surely.
Yeah, I'm gonna explain why Net Ready Eyes is so much better than the Personal Touch. There's a lot of reasons. I've been doing a lot of testing of it in Shaper and Anarch, and I think it's got teeth, and I think it's worth playing in the right metagame at the very least. The reason why Net Ready Eyes plus Yogg is so good is, so when you play the Personal Touch, first of all, you have to play it after you play the Yogg. That's annoying. Because, you know, you might not want to. You might want draw it first, and you're like, okay, I have a window, I can just play this card. Nope, you gotta wait. That's bad. So you don't want to have to do that. Another reason why it's so good is it costs 0, so it's like not really a tempo hit. You can actually, when you control when you take damage, it's actually a lot of the times not as bad as credits, and you can find a window to install it when you might have, you know, some bad cards in your hand. You might even do it when you have an I've Had Worse in hand, which is just completely insane. Like, if you're doing it that way, then it's way, way cheaper than the Personal Touch.
And does it trigger from your own damage?
Yeah, it does. I've Had Worse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so if you can, like, if I'm playing Max and I have Net Ready Eyes, Grimoire, I've Had Worse in my hand, I've already got a Grimoire in play or something like that, I play Net Ready Eyes, and it's like, it costs negative money to play. It's like, it costs negative $1 in a click. It was so good. Then here's the main reason why Net Ready is so much better than the Personal Touch. Once you get Net Ready Eyes plus Yogg out, they stop rezzing code gates that aren't Tollbooth, exactly, because they don't do anything anymore. So suddenly, you've got this Yogg with a Personal Touch in play, right? And while you've negated all their code gates, that Yogg plus Personal Touch isn't doing very much icebreaking, if anything. Once they stop rezzing code gates, now your Net Ready Eyes starts pumping your Corroder every time you're going to go into an Eli. It starts pumping your Mimic every time you run into a server, and you're not really sure what sort of sentries might be there. Let's say you don't have enough data sucker counters, there might be Grimms, there might be Archers. Ichi 1.0, Cortex Slot. So you get all this protection from Mimic. So basically, like, while you're running with this card, the Personal Touch wasn't doing anything, but Net Ready Eyes is being, you know, anti-big sentry insurance, and it's being bad publicity for whenever you need a pump or break with Corroder.
Yeah, I guess it's basically the difference between, in Magic the Gathering, having an equipment that's 0 to equip or having an aura. You can play the equipment before the creature comes into play, you can equip for 0, whereas an aura just, you have to play after the creature and it sits on it. This is the same thing.
Because you don't even need to spend anything to equip. Yeah, it's like a 0 cost equipment. Yeah, I guess that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Just moving on, while we've got a few minutes left, as everyone knows, Dan did win the 2014 World Championship last year, and one of the more than one prize you got is the ability to design a card for an upcoming cycle.
Wait, I thought we were talking about the backpack.
Oh, yeah. So did you get a backpack as well, Dan? That's insane. Like, we were going to talk about the card you were designing, but let's hear more about the backpack. How many pockets does it have?
I don't know. I didn't really open it. I sold it on eBay for $68.
All right. We're not sure how much exactly you can tell us about the card you're designing, Dan, but anything you can, my nipples are hard. Go ahead.
Okay, so the card that I'm designing is a runner card. So it's a runner event. We're thinking it's going to be neutral, and it's going to have influence costs, either 1 or 2. Got to decide that, I guess, based on playtesting. So it's going to be called Deuces Wild. And it's this sort of a modular card. You know, everybody that I talk to about Netrunner cards, one of the cards everybody really likes is Infiltration. cards that you want to see more of. It's got this like narrow effect of expose, but when you don't want to use it to expose, it's at least like sort of cycling and giving you a little bit more money. Like if you click to draw, you drew the infiltration, you don't need to expose. You play another click, you play it, you gain the $2. It's like you were just clicking for credits. It's not that bad. So I wanted to make a modular card that has a lot of effects. I'll get a little bit into the effects. So right now it's at 2 cost. There's two effects that are pretty simple. It's a gain $3, so you can just sort of play it for -1 money and then get another effect. First one is gain $3. The second one is draw 2 cards. So one of the simpler ways to play this card, I guess, would be to play it for $3 and 2 cards. So you play this card, you get $1 and you get 2 cards. It's like sort of this like mini little shitty diesel, but because, you know, it's got more options than that, it's a lot more powerful. The third option we're looking at is choose 2 cards in your heap, put one of them on the top of your stack and one of them on the bottom of your stack. So this is like a recursion effect that will let you recur one card to the bottom of your stack, which is maybe useful for like a criminal who loses their breaker and can special order it back up, or maybe for somebody that has milled through their entire deck and will just get to put both of those cards on the top of their deck functionally. You can also use it in conjunction with the draw ability to put a card back on top of your deck and then draw it if you need to get to it more quickly. In that sense, it can sort of act like a weird deja vu. And then the fourth ability that we're looking at, and this is a little bit controversial, and we're not 100% sure that this is okay to print, and we might need to change this one, but the fourth one was going to be look at the top card of R&D.
Oh, that's spicy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to go too deep on it, but I don't think that ability is too controversial. I mean, you've already got that sort of woman in the red dress effect or whatever.
Well, the woman in the red dress lets the court draw it to their hand if they want.
that's true,
that's
yeah.
That's sort of a key escape hatch there.
But, I mean, if it stays at 2 credits, if you're spending 2 credits just to look at the top card of R&D...
But you're choosing 2.
Pretty hit and miss. Oh, you choose 2? Oh, that's fucking insane.
Yeah, I know. Like you gain $1 and look at the top card of R&D. The thing is, looking at the top card of R&D is only that good if it's an agenda. If it's not...
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. So, obviously, there are sometimes... It's sort of like high variance. There's sometimes where you're going to look at the top card of R&D against a Glacier deck that has, like, an 11 cost R&D, and you're like, oh, there's a priority position. I guess I'll go that, get that. You know, that one's pretty good. But
you also have to be able to get in, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have to know you're able to get in. It's not good if the opponent has a Jackson Howard out on the table. That's another key thing.
Yeah, that card sounds so sweet, man.
Like, yeah, that's really dig awesome. It, man. Yeah, I'm super excited, and I hope the community is frothing at the jewels, just waiting to see it. Obviously, it'll still go through some changes. Like, does Lucas's department take care of all the things like influence costs and the final actual credit cost of the card? Or do you have a lot of say on that as well?
No, I pretty much... This is... So I sent Lucas, like, an original version of the card. I told him I wanted to work... I actually sent him, like, a corp version as well. But I decided to bail on the corp version because... we think that it might have been busted with accelerated diagnostics.
Oh, okay, sure.
I don't want to get into that. Yeah. Putting the card on the top and the bottom of your deck like that and stuff like that. We weren't sure, but anyway. So there were like a couple... I think originally, rather than the look at the top card of R&D, there was like some sort of... I think it was like an expose effect, but I don't remember what it... like if it was like expose plus... or something like that. It might have just been exposed.
It does seem cool, though. Do we know when, like, what the time frame is for it being printed?
I actually have no idea. So I know that the 2012 World Championship card was Architect. That came out right before the 2014 World Champion.
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, so, and then the next card, I think, is due to come out in this cycle. So I would assume that my card would probably come out sometime around Worlds of next year.
I wish I had it for the regionals in Adelaide in a couple of weeks, though.
Just quickly, do we know what the 2013 Invitational card is?
I don't know.
No. We
haven't had that guy on our podcast.
That's for sure, though. Go get them and see if they can spoil it.
He's kept it under wraps purposefully. I'm less of the tight-lip type. He refuses to tell anybody.
That's about all we have time for this week on The Winning Agenda. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so via email, thewinningagenda@gmail.com. You can check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Or you can hit us up with all the cool kids on Twitter, @ winning agenda. I just want to say again a big thank you to Dan for coming on the show the last 2 weeks. It's been a pleasure. Really, I just want to reiterate that we're very thankful for you going in depth on all your thoughts and also your invitational card toward the end there. That's really been fantastic, and we really want to have you back on the show in coming episodes. So I hope you've enjoyed yourself as well.
Oh yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, until next week, guys. We'll see you then.
All right, thanks for listening.
See ya.
Thank you.
Goodbye.